Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. I'm your host, Brian Freeman, and I'm the author of 15 best-selling psychological thrillers, including my latest Alter Ego, which is available now from Quercus Hachette. What we do on this show is introduce you to nonfiction authors with great stories to tell. And today, we have a wonderfully witty, utterly gross, and always entertaining history of poison. Yes, that's right. Eleanor Herman is the author of The Royal Art of Poison, which is available right now from St. Martin's Press. And the book will take you on a guided tour of the truly wild and wildly ineffective ways that European royalty tried to avoid being murdered, even as they were unknowingly poisoning themselves with everything from arsenic to mercury in their food, medicine, clothes, and cosmetics. Now, before we go any further, I have to warn you. Are you having dinner? Are you having lunch? Well, you may want to put that aside while you're listening. Now, I'm not suggesting you need royal tasters to check your food, but the fact is, this is one of the most cheerfully disgusting books you are ever likely to read, and I mean that as a compliment. So put down your fork, pump up the volume. We are about to dive into a world of feces, pus, vermin, vomiting, lice, worms, liquefying organs, rotting corpses, and what Eleanor very accurately calls murder most foul. Eleanor, welcome to True Story.
Thank you. I'm finding it hard to talk. You're cracking me up so much.
Well, you were cracking me up in this book. I have to say this was obviously an exhaustively researched book, but really what made it so special for me was your prose. I mean, I just love your descriptions. I just broke out laughing at the daughter of a Venetian nobleman who was eloping with a swaggering sack of Italian testosterone. I just made a note in the book. She is having way too much fun.
You know, I work from home being an author, and when my husband is here, he hears these roars of laughter from my office, and he just knows that I'm writing because I do crack myself up.
Well, now, obviously, royals back then, we're looking in the 16th, 17th centuries, they were pretty paranoid about poison, and not unfairly, many of them had reason to be, but they went to pretty extraordinary lengths to protect themselves, and you described most of the ways they did so as, quote, medically useless and extraordinarily silly. This is in a chapter that you call Unicorn Horns and Rooster Dung, so tell us more.
Well, centuries ago, people would routinely die in their teens, 20s, and 30s, and no one knew exactly why. The state of medical knowledge was worse than nothing. Doctors would more often kill you than cure you. If they left you alone, if you were too poor to afford a doctor, you had a better chance of survival. So these people were dying, and in a royal court, everyone was very suspicious of everyone else, and they thought, oh my gosh, it had to be poison. Everyone here is being poisoned all the time. You know, it could have been malaria or appendicitis or any number of, you know, many things that today are easily cured and treated. So they would employ things, for instance, like a unicorn horn. Royals thought that a unicorn horn, if you waved it over your food, it would start to sweat and tremble if it was in the presence of poison. And they would often, for good measure, you know, dig it into a meat pie or a cake or something just to make sure that there was no poison there. Now well might you wonder, where do they get these unicorn horns? Because today they're very rare these days. And so what they thought were unicorn horns were actually these 7 or 8 foot long spiral tusks of a fish called a narwhal, which is a kind of whale up in the Arctic. And, you know, for centuries, Europeans thought it was odd that all the unicorns went to cold Arctic beaches to die. But they valued their unicorn horns, which were worth about 11 times their weight in gold. So that was one really silly thing they did. The other one was the tasters were really useless, because if I gave you, let's say, a pudding filled with arsenic, it would take you minimally 20 minutes, maybe up to 2 hours, before
this is
you had the first,
right?
Yeah, the first symptoms, you know, you'd feel nausea, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So, you know, when you see these movies where the tester is, you know, sort of nibbling and then nods, "Your Majesty, it's okay," that would have been utterly useless too. So they did a lot of things. They were also worried about poison on objects or poison on clothing. So the king would have his servants lick his knives, forks, spoons, plates, and cups to make sure that, you know, thereby depositing all their germs on it, what they didn't know about germs till the 1870s, and they would even try on the king or queen's underpants to make sure they weren't saturated with some kind of caustic poison that would go into the skin and kill you. Can you imagine trying on underpants and then taking them off and handing them, saying, your Majesty, you can wear them now, they're okay? They even tested the chamber pot. They had someone sit with their bare butt on the chamber pot, and if it didn't burn, then they'd say, okay, Your Majesty, now you can use this. So it was really crazy.
Now, of course, I was reading through the book and I was thinking, okay, I'm laughing at the idea of people using dog piss to get rid of warts. But, you know, I wonder how many people know that the hormone replacement drug Premarin actually got its name from its source material, which is pregnant mare urine. It's horse piss.
You know, certain things I found is that some things don't really change. They change a little bit, but they also stay the same. So I found that these people were poisoning themselves daily. They were so afraid of poison, waving the unicorn horns and all of that, but they were poisoning themselves daily with their cosmetics, with their medications, with their, you know, disgusting, unhygienic lifestyles. And you've got to ask yourself, in our time and place, how are we poisoning ourselves, you know, in terms
of
rising rates of cancer and dementia and autism? We're probably doing something. And 100 years from now, people can look back at us and say, oh, those silly people, if only they knew it was blah, 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 that was you know, causing all of this illness. So I think in a way, even though science is a million times better, we may be in a similar situation.
Sure, sure. Now, the fact that we know now that many of the deaths that people thought may have been murder or poison back then, it did not necessarily help the people who were accused of it back then.
That's true. And what I found is that Italians had the worst reputation for being poisoners. And the fact was that the Duchy of Tuscany and the Republic of Venice actually had what I call poison universities. They were concocting poisons, testing antidotes on volunteers, condemned criminals. And so Italy really was the beating heart of the poison trade. So if anybody got sick and died mysteriously in France or England or Germany, the fingers would point immediately at the poor Italian at court. And in some cases, they were executed. One poor man in France who had nothing to do, as you know, recent medical knowledge tells us, with the death of the heir to the throne in 1536, was pulled apart by four horses just because he was Italian. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about hygiene in this era. You know, in one
or
of my
lack
recent,
thereof?
Or lack thereof. You know, I interviewed Andrew Lawler recently about his book, The Secret Token, which is about the lost colony of Roanoke. And he mentioned that many Europeans, when they came over to America, actually ended up decamping to live with native populations. And I was kind of interested in their motives for doing so. But now, having read your book about conditions back then, I just wonder, were they simply trying to get away from the smell?
Yes, that could certainly be. And in royal courts, there were thousands of people living cheek by jowl. There were nobles and musicians and servants, and there was no running water. So imagine those thousands of people without a toilet, without the ability to easily wash your hands. So every beautiful room had chamber pots in a cabinet somewhere, and people would do their business there. And what really surprised me was that a lot of these noblemen didn't even bother to find a chamber pot. They would just be walking down a hallway in, say, Versailles, and think, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. And they would just drop their britches and do it there and expect a servant to clean it up. And a lot of cases, the servants would say, well, hell, I'm not cleaning that up, you know, and it would just stay there. And if those who love history know that the Tudor courts, the French court, they were always traveling around from one palace to another every 2 weeks. The court of Henry VIII generally made 30 moves a year. It was not for a change of scenery. It was the minute they decamped, there were hundreds of servants with scrub brushes and buckets of hot soapy water ready to scrub all of the urine and feces off of the palace walls and floors.
You know, my listeners are out there saying, God, I thought he was kidding about the idea of not eating while we're listening to this. And now they're like, ah, see, I told you.
You see, he warned you.
Okay, so you devote a large section of the book to vignettes about 20 famous historical figures who were suspected of death by poisoning, everyone from Mozart and Caravaggio to Napoleon and Edward VI. What I really like is the way you kind of tell vivid stories of these people and their lives and death. They're kind of like mini mysteries. And then you also talk about contemporary evaluations of their deaths and then in sort of modern post-mortem assessments of what most likely actually happened. Now, how did you go about researching those stories?
Some of it was just in biographies of the people. A lot of stuff is actually online. These days, it used to be I'd have to get on a plane and go to Europe and look at archives, but these days it is available online. And one thing that's really helpful about royals and famous people of hundreds of years ago is in almost all cases, there were reports of the doctors in the final illness. I think the doctors were afraid they might get hanged themselves if they were suspected of poisoning, so they kept really copious notes that there was a fever, there was vomiting, there was this, there was that. And then an autopsy. So even though the doctors had no idea what they were really seeing, they described it accurately. And these days, even if there's no body, many of these bodies are lost. For instance, most of the French ones were destroyed in the French Revolution by peasants. I can picture them bearing pitchforks, but they broke into all the royal tombs and destroyed the bodies. So, but still, even if there's nobody, if you have these reports of the final illness and the autopsy, modern medical experts can say, oh, it was typhoid fever, or it was tuberculosis, or it was malaria. So it's very clear to people these days what killed most of these individuals.
Now, of all of the folks that you were profiling in the book, did you have a personal favorite among the stories?
Well, there were some that made me really sad. The really touching ones, I think, were about the kids, the young people. There was Edward VI, Henry VIII's heir that he killed all those women to get, and Edward died at the age of 15. He had been king for, 6 years? And he was just, a hardworking, bright, nice little boy and trying so hard to grow up and be a good king for England. And he just got a really painful, disgusting disease. He died slowly and horribly. I mean, as bad as it is these days for a kid to die of, say, cancer, at least there are painkillers. You know, you can manage
right.
that. But imagine, this lasted months. He swelled up. He stank. His fingernails and toenails turned black and fell off. And he died horribly. And given the religious situation in England at the time, they were thinking, well, maybe Catholics did it. So his half-sister, Mary Tudor could become queen and bring back the Catholic Church, or maybe the Puritans did it, so Lady Jane Grey could go in that direction. But the fact was, it was tuberculosis, just a horrifying, slow descent into fatal tuberculosis. So I look at these 20 individuals, and some of them actually were intentionally poisoned. Those were the interesting ones.
Sure. I think one of the things I really enjoyed too is I learned a lot about many of these historical figures that I had certainly never heard before. And you did such a wonderful job of bringing some of these folks to life and making all we see in many cases with the artists, for example, is sort of the work they leave behind. But you really bring them to life on the page. My favorite, I think, was Caravaggio, and I'm gonna read a passage here so that everyone knows the kind of detail they're going to get in your book. So this is about Caravaggio. Much of Caravaggio's life remains as hidden in the shadows as the figures in his paintings, but Roman court records shed some light. He was involved in numerous assaults late at night, beating his victims over the head with the flat of his sword or wounding them. On April 24th, 1604, he smashed a plate of artichokes into the face of a waiter whom he felt had been rude to him. He threw stones at police officers and told them to stick his sword up their arses. On more than one occasion, he was arrested for defacing doors, a common insult of the time, that involved throwing animal bladders of blood and excrement and painting giant erect phalluses. and that people, is one of the tamer passages.
Well, he was a character. And that chapter I thought was interesting because Caravaggio was not alone in being, you know, a sometimes violent, wildly temperamental artist. And what I learned was that the paints that the artists painted with up into the 19th century, they were made of lead, mercury, and arsenic. And to get a really fine tip on their brushes, sometimes they would suck them a little bit, or in the case of Caravaggio, he would do a bit of finger painting, you know, just smear the colors around. And all of this would be absorbed through the skin into the bloodstream, and it would make them crazy and violent. So I think that, you know, the concept of the temperamental artist was not necessarily that they were just really creative people with a temperament. I think a lot of it was induced by slow poisoning through their paints.
Yeah, I was starting to feel a little bit of an inferiority complex here as an artist, that I wasn't living up to the standard these folks were setting. So fortunately, it seems to have been chemical in nature, not personality. So
we could get you a big plate of artichokes, and you could smash it into a waiter's face if you would like.
There we go. Now, I have to say, a lot of people die in some pretty awful ways. In this book, I have to say that for me, the sulfuric acid enema was that was the one that was the most horrifying to me. But what would you consider to be among the worst ways to go that you found in this book?
You know, it would either be the sulfuric acid enema or one of these radioactive poisons that Vladimir Putin has created. The Soviets, shortly after the Russian Revolution in 1917, developed something called the camera, and it's just like a Renaissance Italian poison university, where they invent and test poisons. And so what Vladimir Putin does is he will send out assassins to poison Russian-born journalists or activists or dissidents, no matter where in the world they may be. And the most recent poisoning was only in March, so less than 4 months ago, in Salisbury, England, where he had someone smear a front doorknob of a former Russian spy's house, and the man and his daughter were in the hospital for a couple of months and almost died. So poison is alive and well in the modern world. You know, it's much worse than the Renaissance poisons, which were generally arsenic or mercury-based. And if you've ever had a real true case of food poisoning, that's what it would have been like until you
right.
died. You would die like from dehydration, your organs slowly shutting down. But this radioactive stuff, it's really sinister. It goes in and destroys the cells, it destroys the nerves, your organs slowly shut down. It's just horrifying.
Yeah, you know, reading your section on the Russian approach to poison, I have to say they seem considerably more talented at it than the folks back in the Middle Ages were, and yet they use sort of oddly creative techniques that almost would have seemed appropriate back then. I mean, sticking people with poisoned umbrellas and you know, smearing poison on the doorknob, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, the irony is that hundreds of years ago, like the poison underpants, and none of that would have worked. If a garment or an object had been smeared with some caustic substance and it was against your skin, you'd say, oh, this sort of burns, right? And then you would take it off and you would wash your skin and that would be the end of it. But these days, with these poisons, I've read all you need is, you know, a fraction of what could be on the top of a pinhead, and that could kill you. So it's really quite frightening.
Well, at the end of your book, you have sort of a glossary of different poisons and their symptoms. So as a mystery writer, I have to say thank you. It makes for kind of a nice reference tool. I suppose that's not what you were thinking, but
no, I just want, you know, I wanted to put something just a little fun, if not exactly cheerful, something, you know, just to end on a positive note there.
Well, if people want to learn more about you and your book, where can they go online to find more information?
I have most of the information is on my website, which is www.eleanorherman.com. It's also got some amazingly funny videos. One of them, I'm in full Renaissance costume, doing a poisonous makeup instruction video. You know, you put on the mercury foundation and the arsenic lipstick, and there you're set to go. So there's a lot of information on the website. I'm also on Facebook, Eleanor Herman Author, on Instagram, and on Twitter.
Wonderful. I've got to go check out that video. That sounds absolutely delicious. The book is The Royal Art of Poison by Eleanor Herman, and it is available right now from St. Martin's Press. If you think you've been poisoned, or you're just simply thinking of poisoning someone, this is the book for you. No, I'm just kidding. This is a story that is going to have you laughing and groaning simultaneously, and it will make you very, very happy that you live in the 21st century. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Brian Freeman, and you've been listening to True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. This show is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Be sure to visit authorsontheair.com for more interviews with best-selling writers in every genre. That's authorsontheair.com. And I know you never want to miss an episode of True Story, so go to Facebook and like my show page, facebook.com/truestoryradio. That's facebook.com/truestoryradio, where you can find links to all of my past shows and announcements of what's coming up next. And if you want to find out more about my books, and yes, I know you do, go to my website at bfreemanbooks.com, one word, bfreemanbooks.com, where you'll find plenty of thrillers for the thriller lover reader in your life. Thanks for listening, everybody, and happy reading.